Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. On today's episode, we have James Check, also known as Check Mighty on Twitter. James is a on-chain analytics guru, and he will explain to us what is on-chain analytics and how we can use it in understanding Bitcoin and maybe even making some price predictions.
Good to be here, mate.
Yeah, great to have you on. So before we start, James, maybe you could do a brief intro about yourself and who you are.
Sure. Yeah, so I started life as a civil engineer, actually. So designing everything under the ground. So basements, holes, mines, tunnels. That was kind of my wheelhouse. And I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. I got into the industry in 2018 at the top, but I didn't understand Bitcoin at that point in time, as most of us don't. And I really discovered why Bitcoin is special in around late 2018 into 2019. And around this point in time, on-chain data started to evolve, and the first kind of real metrics that allowed you to visualize and see the market started getting developed, things like the realized cap, MVRV, the likes of Dave Puhl kind of coming up with these initial pioneering metrics. And I developed an interest in markets in that time. Now, in my life as a civil engineer, we deal a lot with risk and probability, and that's essentially what markets are all about. And it kind of combined this fascination I was building with markets with my kind of engineering problem solving, and then just understanding Bitcoin's role in the world moving forward. So those three kind of synergized together, and I started producing content about on-chain data, and I think I was probably the first person to offer, it was kind of like a course, but teaching people how to actually study this stuff. And it's been a journey ever since.
Okay, and now, so you work for Glassnode now also, do you?
Correct. Currently lead analyst at Glassnode. I've been there since February 2021, so just over 3 years now.
Okay, and for folks who don't know, Glassnode is an on-chain analytics toolset.
Correct.
Okay, so you do your own personal course and personal videos and your...
Yeah, so the course is kind of where I started. So building up the course back in the day, no one was teaching on-chain data. That was kind of my contribution, right? And there's some old videos on YouTube where it sounds like I'm sitting in a tin can and I don't have all the audio set up and the rest of it. But then as I moved into Glassnode, essentially I've got all of the data at my disposal. And it just kind of opened the field of what could be done. So basically all the work's been, we've got our newsletter, we've got a whole bunch of tools we've kind of innovated and pioneered around. We've got a weekly video. So all in that same lens of trying to teach people how to use the data, but just with so much more in terms of tool set and what's available to me. You know, Glassnode's essentially got all the data that you need for Bitcoin.
Okay. So for the people who don't know what on-chain analytics is, can you explain it to us?
Absolutely. That's a great question. At the high level, and there's two frameworks I use to try and explain it. The first one is, imagine if you could look at all of the money moving around the SWIFT system, right? You can see dollars moving from one institution to another, from one holder to another. That is essentially what we get to see. We get to see all the transaction activity, all the volume. At Glassnode, we do all the clustering. So we work out who are these coins flowing between? Is this going from an investor to Binance? Is it going from Binance to Coinbase? And you can use that to really understand what the monetary system of Bitcoin is doing. The other framework I use is for people who are doing fundamental analysis in the traditional finance space, you'll look at the quarterly reports for the companies that you're following. Well, Bitcoin gives you a quarterly report every 10 minutes. It's an update of what happened, who changed coins, who's moving them around. And in aggregate, what we're doing is taking all that information and understanding the supply and demand balance. So this kind of stuff is really useful for everyone from the hodler to just understand where we are in the cycle, understanding how profitable everybody is. It's good for active managers and traders because you can essentially see sentiment. You can actually visualize people buying tops, selling bottoms, doing the right thing, doing the wrong thing. You can see what whales are doing versus shrimp. You can see what exchanges are doing. It's essentially looking at the blockchain and extracting useful information from it. And, you know, as with all things, there's some people who do it really well and some people who don't. And it's a very, very early field. And there's just not that many people who have kind of spent a lot of proof of work actually learning how to understand this data. So it's a fascinating field. I love it.
And the key thing that makes this possible is that Bitcoin, all the transactions on the blockchain are all publicly visible. We don't know necessarily always who's behind the transaction. But with analytics, we can sometimes guess if it's large entities.
Correct.
All the transactions are on there on the blockchain.
And the other thing we can do there is we use what we call heuristics. So you'll often hear things like long-term and short-term holders. Because we don't know who is actually transacting, you know, at Glassnode, we know that these are exchanges. We've kind of got them in their own bucket. For everyone who's not an exchange, you can say, well, how long have you held your coin for? And what we found is that 5 months is about 155 days. There's been other people who've done studies and they get 140 or 130, whatever it is, somewhere in that realm of 5 months. Once you've held your coin for 5 months, you're statistically very unlikely to spend it. So you kind of move into that hodler bucket. So we can actually use how long people have held their coin as a bit of a proxy for, are you a trader or a speculator or are you a hodler? And you can start to break down how many of those coins are moving between those two buckets.
Okay. And so for somebody who wants to use those on-chain analytics, what can they be actually used for? Is the goal here to just find out interesting trivia about the network, or is it to make price and investment decisions?
I think let's bring it down to the different people who would use data. My personal favorite is the hodler, right? The average guy who's just trying to stack sats. On-chain data helps you find when has the market completely flushed out, right? When are we, it looks like a bottom. And at the Bitcoin Live conference last year, my presentation was on a textbook Bitcoin market bottom, and the FTX bottom was absolutely textbook. You could not have crossed more T's and dotted more I's on a perfect textbook bottom. And likewise, the tops generally look pretty much the same, right? You're looking for, are all the old hands, like long-term holders, are they spending? Are they taking huge profits? Are we seeing volumes ticking higher? There's all these like things, like a checklist. If you've got all of these things, it's probably getting close to a top. So for the hodler, it's fantastic to just navigate those big cycles. It's also very useful, and I think this is an underappreciated point, and I actually get this feedback quite a bit because the videos we do, it about half hour video once a week, and a lot of people say, I don't really know why the price goes up or down. All I know is that when I watch these videos, you kind of learn, why did price move? They don't care that price sold off 20% or it rallied 30%. What they care about is, oh, it's much easier to hodl because I understand why. And that's a big difference, right? So if you can really simplify it down and just understand why things happen, it actually makes the volatility much, much easier to deal with. So that's kind of the average person, the hodler cohort. There's then a whole other group that I would put under the bucket of asset managers, traders, investors. These are people who are, you know, moving institutional type money. Some of them will do everything from like quant strategies where they like run it through the machine and find out what specific metrics at what time of day and on a Thursday, what's the best time to buy and sell. And, you know, some people are just directional traders, right? They look for certain crossovers and signals. So there's different buckets of people, but broadly speaking, that's kind of the group, right? You've got the long-term people who just want to understand why and what's going on. And you've also got people who are actively trading and you use this data to extract edge.
Okay. So for the average Bitcoin pleb wants to start using on-chain analytics and he's trying to maybe see where we are in the cycle, if we're close to the bottom or close to the top,
yep,
just to kind of understand what's happening a bit, which actual analytics should he look at?
Totally. This is a fantastic question. So for the average pleb, and we did do a report recently about the realized cap. The realized cap is probably the most important foundational metric in all of on-chain data. It is the backbone of all the cool shit that we do. Now, just to kind of put into context, what is the realized cap? The realized cap is the on-chain market cap. At the moment, when we look at the market cap, right, what is it, $1.something trillion for Bitcoin? That is assuming that every single coin, all 19.7 million, are valued at the current spot price. Now, that's not really a very useful tool because Satoshi's coins are lost. Early miner coins are lost. There's about 1.5 million that we know are lost. By my estimate, there's something in the order of about 3.5 to 4.5 million lost coins. Some of those coins moved at $200, $20, $50. Like, should we really be pricing every single one at the spot? Not really. So what the realized cap does is it prices every coin at the time when it last transacted. So Satoshi's coins, even though there's 1.5 million of them, are worth zero, right? The early miners are worth 12 cents. So they're kind of adjusted for what they're actually worth. So now let's go one step further. By the way, this is all based on a thing called price stamping, where we look at every UTXO and we say, right, when was it created and when was it destroyed? And you can assign a price and a time to both of those events, measure the time delta, measure the price delta. So if somebody bought their coin at $1,000 and sells it 4 years later at $10,000, someone else has to come in with that $9,000 difference to buy it. So the realized cap will climb because that coin got revalued from 1,000 to 10,000. This is a capital inflow. So what we see is that when the realized cap trades higher, It's showing that money is coming into Bitcoin. Coins are going from a cheaper cost basis to a higher cost basis. From that, we can extract literal cost bases. We can see where the average purchase price was. And human beings, we're very psychological creatures in markets. If you go from in profit, you're having a great time, the bull market's ripping higher, your coins are in the green, you buy a shitload of coins, and then suddenly the price falls below your level, most people panic, especially newer investors. So knowing where that cost basis is can actually show you where those points of sensitivity is. There's a whole bunch of other things, right? We've got like the MVRV ratio, which is just the derivative of the realized cap. It's just showing you how in profit or losses the market. You've got various other ones about spending and SOPA. And but anyway, there's a whole bunch of tools, but they all come from this very, very simple concept of let's value every coin at the price when it last moved, and let's revalue it every time it spends. And from that, you can extract just an unbelievable amount of information. And for the hodler, derivatives of the realized cap will essentially give you a toolbox to navigate pretty much all market conditions, which is really, really powerful stuff.
Okay. So thanks for giving that summary of those tools. If somebody wants to learn more about the actual tools to understand them a bit deeper, I guess probably the best place would be to go to your course or to your videos.
No, for Glassnode, we've got our insights portal. So we do a weekly newsletter. And then each week we also have about a 25 to half hour video. Okay. And the idea of that is to essentially show people what we're seeing. And we kind of use the market as our muse. So me and my team, we kind of look at what the market is doing. We absorb that information and we say, how can we describe this in our data? Now, what we also do is a couple of bespoke pieces. So that realized cap, for example, we have a whole piece that's just dedicated to understanding that metric. So not only do we do kind of weekly reports and updates on what's going on, we also do bespoke reports, which is like, hey, let's explore this metric and show people how it's done. I would check out that realized cap piece, both the video and the report. That's going to be a great foundation.
And is that free to access that?
Yes. Yes. All okay. Our content and videos are free. So I'm Glassnode, has a YouTube channel at Glassnode, and it's insights.glassnode.com for the actual newsletter.
Okay. Recently, everybody was very excited about the ETFs getting approved. So I'm curious if you have kind of any insights based on on-chain data to tell us about what's happening with the ETFs.
Yeah, the ETFs, I mean, it is a landmark moment. So there's a couple of things there. The first one is that, let me just break down, I've spoken of this before, but it's worth just giving this context. If we break down the FTX onwards, right, from the bottom that was set when FTX blew up onwards, up until about October last year, so from, let's say, November 2022, all the way through to October 2023, we rallied up to about 30K. We never got above 30K. We kind of poked our head up at 31, but we just got pushed back down. That whole area was hodlers only. The only people who were there were the hardcore Bitcoiners who understood what Bitcoin is. So the capital flows are very small. We didn't have very many pullbacks, which is actually very strong, but there wasn't kind of institutional money. There wasn't big capital allocators. Bitcoin was dead for a decade, was the narrative. When we got to October, everything changed. We saw, I mean, not only did price go from like 26 to 45 or something in like a month and a half, less than, but the realized cap, as I said before, started ripping higher. Gradients just shifted massively. Money started coming in. And this was also when the ETFs were starting to get a lot of hype. Approvals were looking like they were increasingly likely. There was
this new money?
New money and institutional in size. And you know, I mean, it's hard to actually measure the difference between institutional versus retail. But I mean, a very simple check, go and look at Google Trends for Bitcoin. There's no retail here. This is the original Bitcoiners and institutional money. That's essentially what we've got coming in at the moment. Those ETFs, they have changed the game because, I mean, the volumes that we're seeing traded and the AUM they have right now, we're talking about billions of dollars. BlackRock's and Fidelity's are both two of the top performing ETFs ever. Really just incredible stuff. And I expect it to slow down at some point because you can't have $100 million flows every day. So for me personally, it's well and truly in excess of what I had anticipated. I'm very, very impressed. Seeing the amount of coins flowing in is just, it's unreal. We can see them and they're completely offsetting GBTC. And GBTC is drawing down a huge amount of coins, like 150,000 or something enormous. That is a huge overhang. And really GBTC is the final, like, I don't know what the right word is, but the final thing hanging over the market between what I'm going to call the old world and the new world. Because I reckon that when you go back and look in time, that the approval of those ETFs is when Bitcoin went from an adolescent to an adult. It stepped across that boundary where we are now in a different and more mature world. And you can see this in market structure, right? Binance has got a regulator sitting on their desk now. FTX is gone. All of the bad lenders from last cycle are gone. Most of the exchanges, it's kind of Coinbase and Binance. That's kind of it. Really, what we've seen is like there's an old world and there's a new world. And I think the ETFs are that line.
For those who don't know what GBTC is, can you maybe just give an explanation?
So GBTC recently converted to an ETF. So it's the biggest spot Bitcoin ETF. But it actually used to be a thing called a closed-end fund. And it was that way for many years. Now, what a closed-end fund means is that coins can go in, but they can't come out. It's like a Hotel California. Now, what happened is back in the old world, there was no way for institutions or big traders to actually get Bitcoin exposure. They couldn't actually buy spot Bitcoin because they need to buy some kind of regulated investment vehicle. So GBTC tried to give them that product. Now, the challenge is that there was a huge premium. So basically, people, it's a long story, but people could buy spot Bitcoin who were capable of doing this, buy spot, send it in to GBTC, get the shares, and then immediately sell those shares, sometimes for 100% profit, just immediately locking in that premium. What happened in 2021 during the bull leg is lots of people did this, and they did it with leverage. So what happened is that there was 661, I think, 1,000 Bitcoin that flowed into GBTC over the course of like 3 or 4 months. And that premium went from 100% to 30% to 20% to 5% to negative because too many people did this trade. Now, when that trade went negative, it blew up people left, right, and center. So it was essentially the widowmaker trade. Lots of people did it, lots of leverage, huge reason that the 2022 bear market played out the way it did. And we're getting towards the back end of that. Now it's converted to an ETF. Coins can actually get redeemed and come out. And it's kind of that final overhang getting cleared out of the industry.
Okay. So you're saying that people are moving their, well, institutions are moving their funds from GBT to other ETFs?
Correct. And there's a few things here, right? GBTC historically had a 2% management fee. They reduced it to a 1.5% management fee, which is egregiously high. All the other ETFs are 25 bips, right? 0.25%. So very, very small fee, the massive fee delta. So what is happening is over time, people are pulling their coins out of GBTC. The challenge is, and I actually suspect that GBTC will be an indicator for the top because a lot of people are going to hold that GBTC because they don't want to realize the tax, right? They don't want to sell an asset that they bought low and then they don't want to lock in the taxes yet. I suspect that people who want to get out of GBTC but want to wait for the right tax opportunity, those flows will come out towards the top of this bull market would be my expectation. And in many ways, keeping an eye on GBTC from that regard is probably not a bad indicator for when things are getting close to the top.
But there's also new money coming in apart from the transfer from GBTC to other ETFs.
Yes, billions of dollars in net inflows. So even if you account for all the outflows from GBTC, the new money coming in has completely offset that. I think it's almost about 50-50. So completely offset GBTC and then added another amount to that. I need to actually check the numbers, but it's really quite incredible stuff.
And the other exciting event, there's a lot of excitement this year. Now there's going to be the halving coming up. So I'm just wondering, what's your take on that? And, you know, after the halving, do you think the price is going to rise or fall? What kind of insights data should we look for?
The halving is one of these things that Bitcoiners debate every 4 years. Is it priced in? Is it not priced in? And actually, I got this question yesterday, and I tried to provide a thoughtful answer to it. The question was, does macro drive Bitcoin price or the halving? And in that instance, which one drives price more, right? Is it macro or the halving? And I thought about this for a while, and my case for the halving has long been the halving matters depending on what the price is. Because if you have a halving, right, we're going to take 450 Bitcoin per day. Now, for the most part, you can safely assume that every coin that's mined is sell-side pressure. Historically speaking, they may hodl it for a little bit, but generally speaking, miners sell pretty much everything. So if you withdraw 450 Bitcoin in new sell-side pressure every day, and the price is at $100,000 versus 50, that's obviously a different proposition because that 450 Bitcoin is worth a lot more, and you need a lot more money to take it at a higher price. So with that as context, what drives Bitcoin's price? Well, macro drives a lot of Bitcoin's price because, you know, we're looking at currency debasement. We're looking at government spending like drunken sailors. In fact, the line that I heard recently, which I enjoyed, was drunken sailors couldn't even open their wallet as fast as what the governments are right now. So we've got so much money getting poured into the system that Bitcoin is responding to it. So when it comes to the halving, it does make a big difference, but it makes a much bigger difference if the price is higher. So in that instance, the impact of the halving is somewhat dependent on what the price is, which means it's somewhat dependent on what macro is doing. So, you know, if Bitcoin went down to 12 bucks, the halving would be irrelevant because it would take one hodler to consume all 450 coins every day. Whereas up at 100,000, it's going to require institutions every day, a new institution coming in with a huge amount of capital to take those coins off the market. So, you know, it all depends on what the price is.
Just anecdotally, I have to say that I meet so many people who don't even know much about Bitcoin or have very little knowledge, but they all know about the halving, and they say, oh, the halving, is the price going to go up? There's this huge expectation, even much more than previous years, because there's always been this pattern, but after the halving, the price has went up. And so I just find there's such a huge expectation by a lot of people that after the halving, the price is going to go up.
And sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? In fact, the Bitcoin Bush Bash in Murrah recently, I gave a talk that basically showed there's this chart that we look at where we're basically looking at when different entities, I'm just going to call them the shrimp for now. We're talking about people who have less than one Bitcoin. I think I had it at less people who have less than 10, but the point is hodlers, right? Sat stackers. When do the sat stackers really start to buy their coins? When do the hodlers really buy their coins? There's actually three periods of time. The first time they do a massive influx of buying, after the bull market top, we have a big sell-off, right? And basically, let's go back to the 2021 example. Prices rallied up to 64,000. It sells off to 30, and the hodlers go, 50% discount? Yeah, I'm in. Done. And they come in and they buy. The second time they buy is FTX and the 2018 bottom, when the market has done its bear market and it collapses. That final sell-off is usually brutal, but the hodlers go, thank you very much, I'm stepping in. And the third time is in the months leading up to and through the halving. They are the three primary periods where hodlers step in and accumulate their coins. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. People think that the halving is going to have an impact, so they buy a shitload of coins. There's less coins to buy, so anyone else who comes in late to that party pushes the price higher, and everyone goes, look, the halving caused the price to go up. It's like, well, look, kind of, but the investors buying the coins made the price go up, and they happened to buy the coins because they knew some other guy was going to come in around the halving and do the same thing. So it's one of these like chicken and egg kind of scenarios, and that's why I like to look at the data and be like, well, what is actually going on? The hodlers are buying. Cool. That's all I need to know, right? That's my takeaway message. The hodlers are buying again. Happy days. Move on.
Is that what you can see from analytics right now, that the long-term holders are buying?
The one thing that the narrative from last cycle that I found hilarious is everyone was saying all the Bitcoin cycle metrics and stuff, the cycles are going to die. Well, every narrative except that has died because Bitcoin is literally doing the exact same thing it does every single cycle. There is nothing different about this cycle whatsoever. It is textbook exactly the same. I think it's fascinating. I don't understand why, but Bitcoin just seems to have this pattern. This is its heartbeat. It does it every single cycle. I look forward to the day when it changes because that means I don't have to like reassess and, you know, go through reestablishing my biases. But for now, everything looks exactly the same as every previous halving. There's basically no difference, which is fascinating.
Okay. So what are some of the signs you look for when we're at the bottom, when we're at the top?
Great question. So in many ways, they're the exact opposite of each other, as you would expect. And if you spend enough time around markets, particularly if you study anything to do with commodity markets and the like, I think the question to ask is, what do you want to see at a bottom? Well, what I want to see is that every single weak hand investor has been purged from the market. There are no more sellers. You want to see huge amounts of losses because basically human beings in markets, we are naturally geared to avoid risk. And what that means is that people will buy their coins at the top and they will hodl and they will hodl and they will hodl and they'll get to the bottom and they go, fuck it, I am out, I'm done. I cannot look at this number anymore. And they capitulate and they lose 50% of their net worth. They turn around, they walk away. Invariably, That's the bottom. So you look for these moments where you can see capital inflows. You can also see capital outflows. When people buy high and they sell low, coins go from 60,000 to 15,000. You can see that on chain. And human beings do this at the same time. We all have this like pre-programmed pain threshold where we eventually just go, I cannot look at this red number anymore. All my friends are calling me an idiot. I'm sick of this Bitcoin thing. I'm done. And they all do it at the same time and they capitulate. That's what you want to see. What else is going on at that time? Normally miners are getting crushed. So hash rate starts to come offline. Your hash ribbons invert. So you've got hash rate falling off a cliff. You've got massive unrealized losses. You've got massive realized losses. The market is dead. Transaction counts are down. Volumes are down. Textbook bottom. This is what the bottom looks like. And strangely enough, at this very moment, you will see the hodlers stepping in and buying as many coins as they can. So every single person who's capitulating and going, I'm done, has another arrow going, thank you very much. Now, at the bull market top, we have the exact opposite. At the bottom, you've got this like massive concentration of coins held by long-term holders. People have held their coins for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, a year, 2 years. That swells up to all-time highs at the lows. In the bull market, it's the exact opposite. Those people who bought at the bottom wait for the news headlines and their dumb friend to be calling them and everyone saying, should I buy? And we're like 2x above all-time high. That's when they're selling. Miners' profitability is through the roof. Things like the Pure Multiple, which is their mining profitability, through the roof. So you look for huge paper gains, huge locked-in gains. So realized profit, unrealized profit. Miners are just making money hand over fist. ASICs are trading for ridiculous prices. There's all these kind of indicators. And finally, all the smart money, long-term supply declines because they're selling and taking those profits. So you see that the dumb money now owns all the coins. So if you think about it, what's the one time you don't want to own Bitcoin? When most of the owners are people who saw it on the news last week and go, oh man, I need to buy this $250,000 Bitcoin because I'm having FOMO. Well, who sold it to you? It's the smart money who bought it 15K. So that's the kind of framework, right? You're looking for these extremes in human behavior. For whatever reason, we just get to visualize and these stuff is just very, very organic and happens time after time.
Okay. So you, for example, you say that at the top, what you have is long-term holders, people who've been around a long time, who understand the cycle, versus start selling off. And you have instead people who are recent and new to Bitcoin buying.
But speculators, traders, yeah. Unsophisticated. Yep.
But with on-chain analytics, like which would we look at to tell us that? How do we know, like, how do we tell that?
So I think probably the best metric to visualize this is called the realized cap HODL waves. It's basically looking at, you've probably seen the HODL waves before. It's basically a breakdown of the supply based on how old it is. Now, the problem with the classic HODL waves is that because it's BTC denominated, they, like, you can see Satoshi's coins. It's this giant blob of 10-year-old Bitcoin. Well, I don't really care about Satoshi's Bitcoin because they're not worth anything in terms of the price when they move. So the realized cap HODL waves is the USD denominated. It looks at every coin when they were acquired, and it breaks down essentially the USD saved, the wealth that's stored in Bitcoin. Show me that by age band. And when you plot it in that format, Satoshi's coins disappear because they're worth zero. And what you see is these big waves of all the new buyers coming in, very hot colors. New buyers always peaks at the top. And old buyers always peaks at the bottom because you've got this like flow of capital between long and short-term holders. So realized cap HODL waves is probably the best metric to start. If you're looking for oscillators to try and pick those tops and bottoms, MVRV and SOPA, they're both oscillators, but they're actually sister metrics. MVRV, and there's different variants for long-term holders, short-term holders, whole market. It's describing the unrealized profit or loss. How much is paper gains or losses is the market holding? And SOPA is how much actual gains, coins that were spent that were locked in. Show me the average profit or loss locked in by investors. And if you look at those two side by side, they tell you the full picture. What does a bull market top look like? Everyone's in ridiculous paper gains, very, very high MVRV across all cohorts. And lots of those guys are actually taking chips off the table, locking in very large profits. So when you've got both of those things hitting extreme values, probably a top. Likewise, at the bottom, people carry enormous losses. They carry that red portfolio the whole way down and they finally capitulate. So when both of those metrics are very low, that's telling you you're probably near a bottom, right? So if you learn just those metrics, I mean, for the average hodler, it'll get you through 90% of the market cycle without a worry.
Okay. Another thing I like to use, a very simple metric, really, something a bit different, but Bitcoin rainbow chart. Have you heard of that?
I have, yes. Yeah. It's a bit of a meme, yeah.
Yeah, so it's very simple, but what do you think of a Bitcoin rainbow chart? Are you a fan of it?
So I respect its meme potential. I personally would never use it because it doesn't kind of fit in my framework of like being rigorous. In many ways, it kind of works because it's hilariously designed to work. There's not a great deal of mathematical rigor to it. So I don't look at it, but that's obviously because I spend all day looking at the data, right? So I've got models coming out my ears. But again, I think there's much better metrics than the rainbow chart, which are kind of anchored in the real behavior of investors. But I can also see why people use it because it's very simple and it keeps working, right? It just gives you a bit of a mind map of where we are.
Yeah, it is very simple. The analytics, like you described, are much better for getting a better insight, but just as a simple thing to look at 1 minute to give people who have no idea about Bitcoin, just kind of, give them an idea of roughly where we are in the cycle.
Yes.
I find it's better than nothing, you know, it's just yeah. A data point, but one data point is better than zero data points.
That's it.
So I had some questions about the kind of different information about the Bitcoin network, but maybe we can use on-chain analytics to answer. I have people asking me some of these questions. Do you know what percentage of Bitcoin is held by whales?
We did a report a little while back called the Shrimp Supply Sink, and we tried to answer this very question. So lots and lots of critics will look and say, oh, look, 95% of Bitcoin is held by five guys. It's like, well, you're actually describing exchange wallets and ETF holdings and whatever. It's not really an accurate view. So if I look at our whales here, whales, something on the order of about 15, maybe 18%, something like that. I'm trying to read off the chart, but probably something on the order of about 15% of the supply is held by actual whales. And this compares to about 20% held by exchanges and miners, right? So, and those miners, by the way, include Satoshi's early lost coins. So, you know, we can actually break it down, but for the most part, the reason that report was called the Shrimp Supply Sink is it's actually showing that over the long arc of time, whales' ownership of Bitcoin is actually decreasing massively. Small guys are actually growing their share. We are seeing the Bitcoin supply distribute further and further over time, not concentrate.
Okay, that's interesting. So you said 18%. Obviously, this is an estimate because we don't know. But so around 18% right now is held by whales. And in that report, what's the definition of a whale?
So we use a 1,000 Bitcoin threshold. And we do clustering. So we basically look at like if a whale happens to have like four or five addresses that they've interacted with and, you know, they've got 500 there and 150 there and 200, like that will cluster them together as best we can. It's never going to be a perfect metric, but for the most part, the supply is distributing over time.
Okay. So I guess maybe you have a chart there. I can see it. But do you have an idea of, for example, like 5 years ago, what percentage was held by whales?
I don't have it in front of me. Yeah. No, yeah. I have to get back to that.
Yeah, okay, no worries. Do you know what percentage of Bitcoin is held in self-custody versus in custodial wallets?
Good question. So essentially, I'm pretty sure exchanges from memory is about 12.5% of supply. That doesn't include ETF products, however. So you then have to add in there something on the order of, I would say there's probably about 3 or 4 million Bitcoin held in custody. Now, bear in mind, that includes exchanges, but also ETF products, institutional custody. I mean, Coinbase custody alone has a huge amount of this supply. You then have to look at lost coins, right? And there's no way to perfectly estimate it in terms of lost coins. We know there's about 1.5 million that are lost. There's probably up to about between 3.5 and 4.5 million that are probably lost. So you've got 3.5 to 4 million that are lost, about 3 to 4 million that is in custodial setups. Everything in between there is going to be a self-custody bucket. So whatever that works out in the math.
Okay. And so the next question, do you have any idea what percentage of Bitcoin are held kind of in deep cold storage and, you know, haven't been used for a long time?
Yeah, that's essentially where you would look at long-term holder supply. So long-term holders, and now these are coins that have been held for more than 5 months. And the reason, again, we use that is it statistically tells you that there's a that's the majority that are held in deep cold storage. About 14.6 million are currently in long-term supply. Now, we have to subtract, just for easy math, let's just subtract the upper bound of our lost coins, 4.5 million. So you're talking about 10 million thereabouts that's going to be in relatively deep cold storage. Okay. And that's coming off the all-time high, by the way, and isn't lost.
So how much did you say? 10 million?
Over 10 million.
Isn't lost, yeah. Okay. But also answers my next question. You estimate around 4.6 million has been lost.
Yeah, so we Dave Puhle and I actually last year released a report called Coin Time Economics, which is a whole framework. And again, it's the most abstract thing I've ever worked on by far. Even I don't fully understand it, to be honest. I'm still getting my head around it. But as part of that, we use the holding time of Bitcoin. Like we use this thing called coin days, which is like how many days since a unit of Bitcoin has moved. And we use that to calculate a best estimate of how many lost coins there are. And we came up with, I can't remember the exact numbers, about 3.8 to 4.2 or something million of the 21 million. We estimate somewhere between about 18 and 23% is lost. So you can never perfectly know because like literally someone could withdraw right now and immediately lose their coins and we won't know. So at some point it goes from, it looks alive and then it doesn't move for 50 years. You're like, well, it's probably lost, right? So there's this kind of like grading curve.
That's interesting. Yeah, thanks for providing that info. Is there any other kind of maybe interesting trivia or facts you have about Bitcoin kind of based on chain analytics?
One of my favorite charts over the last cycle, actually there's two. The one that I think is more useful, more interesting, is if we look at the amount of coins that shrimp buy, I believe there's a chart that shows the success of Bitcoin education, right? So I got in 2018, the education was very small, right? Over the course of 2019, 20, 21, the Bitcoin education suite, people building content expanded massively. Now, if you go back to the 2017 top, shrimp, people with less than one Bitcoin, the little guy, the average punter, they bought an all-time high, like the 30-day change in their balance, they just bought a shitload of coins. But that was very fleeting. It was like a big buy into the top, and then they got rinsed the whole way down. The amount to which the shrimp balance increased never came even remotely close, not even during the 2021 bull market. Didn't even get close to that level. It got to that level. And remember, 2017, the peak was 20,000. It reached that level in 2022 when we sold off to 20,000, when Three Arrows blew up and then FTX blew up and Luna blew up. The shrimp then just started ripping into it and buying. They've hit massively high levels ever since. That to me, I mean, think about the kind of person who buys the top in 2017, that was me, and then goes through the bear market, doesn't really understand what they're doing, but they learn about Bitcoin. Eventually, price comes back down to 20,000 or 15,000. I mean, that was a crazy time. When FTX blew up, the narrative was that Bitcoin was dead for a decade. Imagine stepping in and buying coins en masse at that time. You have to be seriously hardcore. But the shrimp did it. And they did it in a size that we just have never seen before, blew out all-time highs. So to me, that describes the success of Bitcoin education, hardening people up from buying the top in 2017 to buying the absolute bottom in conviction and size in 2022. That to me is, I think that's my favorite chart because it really describes how successful Bitcoin education has been over the years. The only other fun fact is that since the FTX lows, we haven't even had a 20% correction, which is by far the most powerful uptrend Bitcoin has ever seen. So this up leg has been really, really one for the history books. The people who wanted to buy the dip have had no dips to buy. It's been pretty historic by that metric.
Okay. So you're saying basically that the people who used to be dumb money, excuse for losing the term, but dumb money learns on their mistake. And after like a cycle or two, it becomes smart money.
I think it's such an amazing thing to see because I've lived through the process of the education growing from nothing to something. And it's been a journey and I can see myself in the data, which is a point that I often use for hodlers. Can you see yourself in the data? If so, it means you're looking at the data the right way.
And another thing all this tells me that it's very likely that we're going to have less volatility in Bitcoin. Even you said we haven't had less than a 20% downturn during the last year or something where previously we had. And like because of these patterns, because people becoming smarter about the cycles and Bitcoin's become bigger, in terms of the kind of expectation, looking at the like the increases and decreases, it's very natural to expect that the cycles won't be as volatile. Each cycle becomes less volatile.
Yep. Well, I mean, if you look at realized volatility across any time frame, it is measurably less volatile, right? We've seen, I mean, I'm looking at it right now, realized volatility over a 3 month, 6 month, 1 year time frame is down to 43-45%. If we wind back the clock to the 2021 peak, we're talking about 87-95-75% back in 2017 and 18, 136%, 110-105%. So we are like 30% of what we were in 2017, and we're 50% where we were in 2021. So measurably, the volatility is coming down already. This is already in play.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else, James, you want to cover, or how we can find you? Anything else you want to share?
No, I think we went over all the good stuff. If you want to find me, you'll find me at @checkmatey_ on Twitter. And if you want to follow my work, go to insights.glassnode.com. You'll find our blog. If you check out the Bitcoin analysis section, we have a lot of stuff with that realized cap piece that I mentioned. And we also every Tuesday put out a video on @Glassnode for YouTube. So be sure to check that out.
Yeah, and you also be speaking at Bitcoin Alive, I believe.
I will be at Bitcoin Alive, yes. So if you're around, come and say hi.
If you haven't put your ticket yet to Bitcoin Alive, Hardblock is sponsoring it. And you can use the discount code Hardblock to get a 10% discount. So if you haven't bought a ticket, Bitcoin Live, it's going to be the biggest Bitcoin conference in Australia, biggest Bitcoin event.
Should be a good day.
Yeah. So thanks for your time, James, and talk to you next time.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a pleasure.